some very recent work. In fact, we haven't quite finished the paper on this, so it will be coming out onto the archive in probably in a couple of weeks. And it's joint work with my PhD student, Hussein, and also Earl Campbell, who's in Berlin. And this particular work that I'm going to talk to you about has really been pushed forward by Earl, so he's really taken the lead in this project. But I'm going to tell you about it today. So I'll start. This is going to be a fairly technical talk, and I'll give you sort of, without going through all the details, I'll give you sort of a flavor of a lot of the analytic proofs that go into these results. But just to start, I'll give you an overview and tell you what magic state distillation is, for those of you who aren't familiar with it. And it's very much motivated by fault-tolerant quantum computation and the fact that in many implementations of fault-tolerant quantum computation, here's a nice example, the scheme by Rausendorf, Harrington, and Goyal, using three-dimensional cluster states. In many schemes of this form, sort of the vocabulary of unitary gates that you can implement fault-tolerantly is limited. So there's normally a finite set of fault-tolerant gates that sort of come naturally to your system. And in most examples, this is the Clifford group or a subset of the Clifford group. So for example, in Rausendorf's paper, they can implement just a very small set of operations, the CNOT gate, preparation of Z eigenstates and X eigenstates, and measurements in the same bases. But nevertheless, by using magic state distillation, this can be promoted to universal quantum computation and without affecting the error thresholds of their scheme. So I should say that magic state distillation is only one of many ways of enhancing a fault-tolerant realization of quantum computation, but it has some very nice properties. And you can really, the motivation behind this is state injection. So I'm sure you'll all be familiar with the idea of state injection. It's the idea that we can use a prepared auxiliary qubit in combination with unitary gates that we already have in order to implement a unitary gate outside that set. It's very easy to derive, starting from this lovely one-bit teleportation circuit, which I'm sure you all know very well. So the idea of this circuit is that with this sequence of Clifford group operations, starting with a qubit down here, we prepare an ancilla in this plus state, perform the sequence of Clifford group unitaries and measurement, and we end up with this qubit state over on this other qubit. So we sort of move the qubit from there to there. Okay, so that seems very simple, but this is a very nice building block when you want to start modifying things. So for example, you can derive cluster state measurement based quantum computation starting from this picture. But we can also derive state injection too, just by the very simple realization that if we make a small modification to this, so we add a unitary, and this unitary will commute with this controlled NOT gate. So the UZ denotes its diagonal in the Z basis. And you see this unitary here was a correction which is made dependent on the outcome of this measurement. So if we alter this accordingly and insert this unitary here, then we get a transformed state at the output. And then the idea behind state injection is just to realize that with this setup, we can imagine absorbing this unitary into the state preparation here, and then this state here acts as a resource for implementing this unitary here. And if this unitary is well chosen, we can choose it such that this operator here is still in the Clifford group, so it's still within our vocabulary of allowed operations. So that's the basic idea of state injection. And famously for qubits, the gate which does this is the pi over 8 Z rotation. So magic state distillation is a means to prepare approximately the resource states that you use for state injection and therefore promote a Clifford group fault-tolerant realization to a universal quantum computer. And the key thing is that magic state distillation itself only requires these same stabilizer operations. So this is a sort of a schematic of the magic state distillation scheme that was proposed by Brevi and Kataev back in 2004, 2005. And the idea is you imagine that you, in order to create this state uz plus, you have to use an operation which is outside your set of fault tolerant operations, so it's necessarily noisy. So this will not prepare the state we wanted. Instead, it will prepare a mixed state, which is hopefully suitably close to the state we wanted. And what magic state distillation does is it takes many copies of this state, and via a sequence of stabilizer operations, it produces a smaller number of states which are closer to this desired target state. And then through repetition of this process, you can get arbitrarily close to the state that you wanted. And when you get close enough, then you can use this as a resource for your to implement these non-stabilizer gates. Okay. And the structure of the magic state distillation is on this slide. Bravi and Kataev presented two different protocols in their paper, but all of them had this structure. And it's very simple. So this is a single iterate of their protocol. So imagine rho I is, say, the mixed state that we have after I iterations. We take n copies of this state. We twirl them through a Clifford symmetry. This means we take a particular subgroup of the Clifford group, and we apply this uniformly to each of these qubits. So we apply randomly, uniformly, elements of a Clifford subgroup, and that twirls this into a particular form. We then measure the stabilizer of a particular code. So every magic state distillation protocol is essentially defined by a quantum error correcting code. What we do, by measuring the stabilizer, we project onto the code space of the code. Now, this isn't sort of typical quantum error correction, because we didn't start out close to this code space. In fact, we started out with a factorized state. Nevertheless, on the condition that no error were detected, in the condition that you've projected onto the code space, if you decode, you get back one qubit, which provided your initial state was above a certain threshold, this will be distilled to closer to your target state. So basically, each step of this process, provided you are within a certain distance from the state you want to get to, it will distill you towards that state. And this is a sort of a summary on one slide of most of the early work in magic state distillation. So there were really three key papers, the paper by Bravi and Kataev, and a few papers by Ben Reichardt. They looked in particular at three codes. We have the so-called 15-qubit Reed-Muller code. I'll speak at length about Reed-Muller codes later in my talk. The Steen code and the 5-qubit code. And each of these distill certain states. And in particular, the states which arise in these qubit magic state distillation protocols are the H state and the T state. It's a little bit hard to see this image here, but the H state is just it's an eigenstate of the Hadamard operator. So it lives on the Bloch sphere halfway between the zero state and the plus state. And if we think of the Pauli eigenstates giving us the extreme points of an octahedron, the T states are the states which live above the symmetry rotation, the 120 degree rotation of this triangular face, which is represented by this arrow here. So the T state and the H state lives over here. And both of these states are suitable for state injection to implement non-Clifford unitaries. Okay, so these are the sort of thresholds that are found for these schemes. There are various ways you can quantify the distance from your target state. I'm going to use a very simple measure, which is the measure used by Bravi and Kataev, which is just 1 minus the fidelity with respect to the target state. And these are the sort of thresholds that you find in these magic state distillation protocols. And as you can see, they're rather high. I mean, we can tolerate quite a large amount of noise before these schemes will fail. Okay, so this was all done sort of 7 years ago. So why are we coming back to it now? Why are we thinking about qudits? Well, this was sort of inspired partly by thinking about fault-tolerant quantum computation. And there's a remark at the end of Manny Neal's paper on this from 2004, where he just wonders, he puts a thought out there, could Q-trits help reduce the fault tolerance threshold? You know, if we work with higher dimensional codes, some of these dimensions have codes which have properties very different to in the qubit case. In many respects, qubits are very special. And you know, the higher dimensional systems, the Q-dits, often have properties which qubits don't share. So a nice example is the existence of three Q-trit codes that you don't get three qubit error correcting codes, and yet they exist for Q-trits. And surprisingly little work has gone on to follow this idea up. I mean, there was, in the early days of fault tolerance, there were a few papers on implementing fault tolerance in higher dimensional systems, and I'll mention some of those as I continue. But in terms of these more recent schemes, such as Rausendorf et al. And Nil's high threshold schemes, the generalization to Q-dits has not been done. And it does seem feasible that maybe Manny Neal's intuition is correct and the thresholds might be at least as good, but maybe slightly better. So this is sort of the motivation for this work, because magic state distillation really is a key component of both Manny Neal's fault tolerance scheme and also Rausendorf et al.'s schemes. Okay, so I should talk about some prior work, and it's very recent prior work, because both of these papers are from this year. So actually the first paper to come out on magic state distillation generalized to Q-dits was a no-go theorem. And the authors, all three of them are here in this room. And in this paper, what they showed was that certain states can't be distilled by any magic state distillation protocol. Now we know that the stabilizer states can't be distilled. If a state is a mixture of Pauli eigenstates, then you know, the action of a stabilizer circuit, such as magic state distillation, will be classically efficiently simulatable via the Gossmann-Nil theorem. So we know that states that are mixtures of stabilizer states can't be distilled. But there are also a class of states outside this region, which you can also prove to be undistillable. And we call these bound states in analogy with entanglement theory. And in particular, Veitch, Perry, and Emerson have shown that the states with a positive Wigner function cannot be distilled by any magic state distillation protocol. Essentially, the stabilizer operation preserve the positivity of the Wigner function, so you can't get out to these interesting states on the edge where you want to be. And now, that was the first paper on Q-dit magic state distillation. And at the same time, we were working in the other direction, trying to show that Q-dit magic state distillation even works in principle. And so our paper, which came out a couple of months ago, is a numerical investigation into this. I mean, we literally just took some codes and we tried it, and it worked. And in particular, we show that you can construct protocols based on the 5 Q-trit code and the Steen code. But because this is numerical work, it doesn't generalize very well, and we don't get so many general insights. So the aim of the work that I'm going to talk to you about today is to do this analytically and to find a model of Q-dit magic state distillation that you can study completely analytically, so you can understand and you can show that it works in all prime dimensions and get a good insight as to why it works. So that's the main result. We're going to show that magic state distillation is possible in all dimensions, or all prime dimensions, I should say. And the technique we're going to use is higher dimensional analogs of the quantum Reed-Muller codes. And in particular, a very special property that they have, which is a transversal non-Clifford group gate. So this is sort of the structure of my talk. As you see, there's a lot to get through. But I think this initial section, I can go very quickly, because I think everyone in this room has a good background in the basics of quantum error correction theory. And several of you are far more expert in this than I am. So I'll go over that fairly quickly, but it's good to set some notation and refresh refresh our knowledge of this area. I'll first talk about Q-dits and just show how we get to Q-dits from qubits very simply. Then I'll remind you of the CSS construction for quantum codes and how it's based on linear codes. And then we'll go straight to generalizing the read-muller code to qubits. And we'll investigate the transversal gates that it supports. And then we'll show how the nice properties of these transversal gates lead us directly to magic state distillation schemes. Okay, so here's a slide which we all are very familiar with. So this is single qubits. Now this slide is merely here so we can look at the difference when we move to qdits. And many things change. In particular, very strikingly, the geometry of the state space changes quite dramatically. Qubits very famously, as beautifully described in Marcus's talk yesterday, can be represented on a block sphere. But when we try and generalize this to higher dimensions, we find it fails. The state space simply isn't spherical. And this is a picture which Marcus used in his talk. It's a lovely picture. This is a paper where they try and visualize these higher dimensional state spaces. And in order to do so, they actually construct analogs of things which sort of reflect some aspects of these higher dimensional spaces. So you should think of them sort of like this. I mean, for the purposes of this talk, we don't need to think too deeply about this. But the take-home message is the state space is different. And initially, you might think this might be a big problem for magic state distillation, because one of the really striking things about qubit magic state distillation is the Clifford group symmetry about it. The magic states were all eigenstates of Clifford group operators, and you could see they were very closely related to symmetries of an octahedron. And we don't really have those symmetries in quite the same way in these high-dimensional systems. In terms of the description, it's very, very similar. We generalize our Pauli operators in a very natural way. So the X operator is now the sort of a shift operator, which moves us from state J to state J plus 1. And that's modulo D. All of the description of these operators uses now a new field, which is a prime dimension field. And that means that it has a very simple description. It can be described in terms of integers and modular arithmetic. So finite fields can be very scary things, but the prime dimensional finite fields are easy. It's just modular arithmetic, modulo D. So what are the differences here? Well, the most striking difference is that X and Z are no longer self-inverse. And also the anti-commutation relation is replaced by this omega commutation relation. So we want to describe many qubits, or many qdits. So the natural thing to do is use the Pauli group. The Pauli group generalizes, again, very naturally. Just to introduce some notation, I'll often write operators like this. So an operator with square brackets and a vector u. So u is a bit string in this example. In general, these u's will be dit strings. So they'll be elements of field fnd. And these vectors, we'll manipulate them using modular arithmetic bitwise. Okay, so this u is a vector living in this field, and it labels a tensor product of operators. So basically, these integers represent here the presence or absence of the operator x on these three qubits, and similarly for this operator z here. And straightforwardly, we can write down commutation relations here. The main thing I want to emphasize is that very neatly, the commutation relation between a string of X operators and a string of Z operators is given by this inner product here. So if this inner product between these two vectors, U and V, is zero, then the operators commute, otherwise they don't. Okay, so this all generalizes to qdits in a very similar way. And similarly, we can describe our tensor products of operators in a similar notation. And just the same as before, when we have two of these operators, a tensor product of x's and a tensor product of z's, these things will commute if and only if the inner product between these two vectors is zero. So this is going to play an important role. So what do we know about computation for qdits? Well, again, there are many analogs with the qubit case. We have the Clifford group, which is just the group which permutes the Pauli group elements while preserving their commutation relations. And we know it's generated by C naught H and this P gate, which is the square root of Z. We know that the Clifford group, when it acts on Pauli eigenstates, is efficiently simulatable on a classical computer. That's the Gossmann-Nil theorem. And so we know that the Clifford group unitaries on their own are not universal for quantum computation. But we need to add surprisingly little to this set to gain a universal set. So in fact, the Toffoli gate can be added, the pi over 8 gate can be added, or indeed any non-Clifford gate will promote the Clifford group to an approximately universal gate set. For Q-dits, it's very similar. So we're going to use the this representation of the Q-dit Clifford group from Daniel. It's very similar. There's some slight modifications. Notably, the P gate is rather different. It's no longer the square root of Z. And there are some additional things we can do. But the main structure is the same. The simulatability result is the same, essentially. And similarly, we can add other gates to the Clifford group to get a universal gate set. Now, this was shown in 1997 that the Clifford group augmented with the Toffoli gate is approximately universal. But so far, it is not known, at least we do not know, whether this holds true for any non-Clifford gate.
I think it's in that same Rains et al. Paper at the end that they say that, I think maybe for prime Dimekians, and maybe not for prime powers.
So this may be true. This is something we're looking into at the moment. So we had, Earl posted a question along these lines on the Stack Exchange website, which very helpfully both Daniel and Peter Shaw got involved with and gave us some useful hints. So we're certainly making progress here. But this beautiful paper is very hard to read. It's very mathematically dense, and we haven't quite got everything out of it. So certainly it is certainly possible that this is a corollary of the results in this paper, and we certainly believe this to be true, but I wouldn't guarantee it yet. Okay, so we're going to build CSS codes, and CSS codes are constructed from linear codes. You remember that linear codes are classical codes which are constructed from bit strings or n-digit vectors. I think from now on, I'm going to leave the bit world behind, and everything is going to be dimension d. So that means these classical codes are constructed from finite field prime order. And the linear codes have the nice property that for any two code words, their sum, which is the digit-wise sum, is also in the code. And this means there's sort of an abelian group structure, which you can get from the addition. And you can sort of construct the whole code from a small set of generators. See, so this generators here constructs this whole code just by linear combinations. A very important idea in linear code theory is the concept of a dual code. So the dual code is the set of n-digit vectors which are orthogonal to the code. Now, orthogonality here means with respect to this inner product here, which is the inner product modulo d. Now, this inner product is a very different beast to the standard inner product we use in quantum mechanics. So any intuitions about inner products should be cast away. In particular, vectors, sort of non-trivial vectors, can be self-orthogonal. And the dual code represents the set of all vectors which are orthogonal to all of the vectors in the code. And we normally write this C perp. Okay, so this is the definition. You can see by the symmetry of it that this is an involution, so C perp perp is C. And you can really think of these. The reason why these are important is they play the same role as the stabilizer does for quantum codes. And essentially, the dual codes tells you the parity checks which your code words have to pass in order to not have an error. And through the symmetry of this, you can think of the code as the stabilizer of the dual, or the dual is the stabilizer of the code. It works both ways. Okay? And in particular, some codes are self-dual, meaning that they're orthogonal to all their vectors, and indeed they're equal to the set of all vectors orthogonal to them. And you get codes that are weakly self-dual, which means they are in their dual. And these the duality concept is very important in the CSS construction, as we'll get to on the next slide. So just as an example of this, this is the generator of the dual code for the code I had on the previous slide. Okay, so now we're going to go to the CSS construction, very important construction for building quantum codes. And it's based on a very simple idea. Basically, what you do is you take two classical codes. One of them protects against Z errors. The other one protects against X errors. And we can construct a stabilizer code very explicitly. We take a classical code CX, and we build from CX the X stabilizer for our code. So literally, for every vector in CX gives us a stabilizer through our notation here. So this, we just construct the X stabilizers from the vectors in CX. And we can take another code, CZ, and construct the stabilizers directly from the code CZ. Now, this is not the textbook way of introducing CSS codes, but this is more symmetric, and I prefer it. So if we do this in the right way, we get a quantum code. So what is the right way? Well, firstly, we need for our stabilizer elements to commute. And that means we need to go back and think about these inner products. You remember that this was the commutation relation between operators of this form. And if this inner product is going to be zero, what this means is it means that these code words have to be in the dual of the other code. So we get this nice condition, which if satisfied, guarantees that our stabilizer operators will commute with one another. And the other thing to check is that is the dimension of our code and the fact we're actually encoding any qubits. But that's straightforward to check just from the dimensions of these codes and the number of stabilizer generators that we get. Okay, so that was sort of my whistle-stop tour of quantum error correcting code theory. So now I'll move on to the main topic of the talk. And really, the main body of this is going to be deriving this QDIP version of the Reed-Muller code and demonstrating its transversality properties. So what are Reed-Muller codes? For those of you who aren't familiar with them, the construction is remarkably simple. These are code words constructed from polynomials. So well, in particular, they're polynomials, but it's good to think of them as Boolean functions. So a Boolean function is a map from m digits to a single digit. So for example, here is the Boolean AND function. And we can write out a truth table for the Boolean AND function, and we can list the outputs of the function 0, 0, 0, 1. So what does the Reed-Muller code construction do? It takes this output list here in the truth table and converts it into a vector. So a Reed-Muller code is a code constructed of vectors where every vector is defined by a function. It's the output, it's the list of outputs of a particular Boolean function. Okay? And in particular, Reed-Muller codes are generated by functions represented by monomials up to a certain degree. So what that means is, for example, in our notation here, we write these codes RMD. So little d is the dimension. R is the degree, the maximal degree of the code. And M is the number of digits in the inputs to the generating Boolean function. So our Boolean functions that generate our code are maps from m digits to a single digit. Okay. So to give an example of this, very simply, if we take the code RM202, if r equals 0, we're generating this from 0-degree monomials. That means the constant function. The constant function has the truth table 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. So we get the 1, 1, 1 vector as our only generator. Okay? And of course, we always, in any linear code, we always get the all zeros vector. A slightly more complicated code is this one, RM312. So this is a TRIT code of degree 1 with m equals 2. So now we have three generators. They're the linear functions. So the generators are just given by monomials of degree less than or equal to 1. So the only monomials of degree less than or equal to 1 in this case are 1, x1, and x2. And you see I've just written out the truth tables for each of these functions. These three vectors are now the generators of this code. So that's the Reed-Muller code construction. And it's had a sort of central role in linear code theory because it has a wealth of beautiful properties. One of it is the duality property. You can check that it's weakly self-dual, so every vector is orthogonal to every other vector in the code. But even more than that, the dual of a read-muller code is another read-muller code, and by this formula here. So if we have a read-muller code of degree r, the dual is the read-muller code for m times d minus 1 minus r minus 1. And of course, this formula only works if this value here is greater or equal to 0. So you'll recall in my introduction to the CSS construction that the key to constructing CSS codes is showing that your two codes are within each other's dual. When you have self-duality, this sort of immediately suggests that these codes will be good for quantum codes. And indeed, this was certainly noticed very early in the development of quantum codes. So this paper here by Neil Laflamme and Zurich from 96, where they look at the read-muller codes as well as many other codes and demonstrate this explicitly. There's also a paper by Andrew Steen, which sort of goes into more detail and describes other quantum read-muller codes. But really, the method we're going to use now is the d-dimensional generalization of some of the work in this paper from 96 by Neil Laflamme and Zurich. Okay, so one last technical property of these generalized read-muller codes. So when I say a generalized code, generalized in linear code language just means d greater than 2. So these generalized codes are just read-muller codes on fields other than the binary vectors. So these codes have a lot of symmetry, and in particular, the r equals 1 codes have a beautiful symmetry which we're going to exploit to generate transverse gates. And you can see here, this symmetry is exposed by these things which we call k-weights. So the k-weight is a generalization of the Hamming weight. Hamming weight of a binary code is just the number of non-zero elements in the vector. In this case, the k-weight is just the number of occurrences of the integer k in the code. So for example, in this bit string, or in this all one bit strings, the zero weight is 0, and the one weight is 9. But if we look at these other codes, which, a little bit small on this screen, but these are the codes generated by x1, x2, and x1 plus x2. These all have this beautiful symmetry that the k-weight for 0, 1, and 2 is equal to 3. And this is true for all of these codes. And this symmetry we will use directly to get our transversal gates. OK, and we're not going to use the read-muller codes as I've just described. We're going to modify them slightly. We're going to shorten them. So we shorten them in two stages. First, we puncture them. So this is using the jargon of linear code theory. So to puncture a code is just to remove a bit from every code word. So the bit we're going to remove is going to be the first bit. Okay. Then we're going to shorten our code, which means after we've punctured it, we remove one of the generators. And the generator we're going to remove is the all ones generator. So this means now our read-muller code has lost the first bit, and it's lost the all ones generator. Okay, so now the duality has a really nice property, which will go straight into the CSS construction. And now we see the dual of these shortened codes is still a shortened code, but with the all ones vector having to be added back. Okay. And what's it done to the k-weights? Well, it's added an asymmetry into the k-weight. So now the weight for the 0 is smaller because we've just removed zeros. So in fact, all of the code word, all of the generators which are left in the code would have had 0 in their first element. Okay, so that's put an asymmetry into these k-weights. Okay, so now to the quantum code. How do we construct it? Well, we just use these shortened read-muller codes. So for our x stabilizers, we use the r equals 1 code. And for the z stabilizers, we use it's almost the dual code. It's the dual code, but I've removed that extra all ones generator. So it's another shortened read-muller code. The logical operators on the code space really there's only one thing they can be, because remember, these operators also have to commute with the stabilizer. The fact that they commute with the stabilizer means they have to be constructed from a vector which was in the dual, and the only vector in the dual which I haven't used in the stabilizer is the all ones vector. So the logical operators all have to be act transversely, and here they are. So the x is the x applied to every qubit. The z, it turns out, has to be z dagger to get the right commutation relation. And these are the logical basis states. So this construction is just standard CSS code construction. If you haven't seen it before, don't worry. But we can derive this just by, you know, standard stabilizer formalism. Okay, and the thing to notice here is that each of these code words is an equal superposition over a coset of the code. Basically, we've taken our code and we've added an integer multiple of the all ones vector. And that's easy to see because our x operator, our logical x, which maps codes which maps us from one logical code state to the next, is the all one. Is this tensor product of x's transversely. Okay, so examples. So qubit examples are well known. If we take, so just actually before I go on to dwell on my notation, I'm going to define the codes QRMDM, where D refers to their dimension, and M is the number of digits which is generating our read Muller code. So the length of the code is 2 to the M minus 1. So the Steen code is QRM23. The 15-qubit read Muller code derived by Neil LaFlamme and Zurich is QRM24. And there's a nice one which we can get from the code RM312, which was the code I illustrated before. And it's an 8-qutrick code. And we've really, by writing out the code, this tells us what the stabilizer generators are. And we can write down the code words. You can see they have this nice symmetry. Okay, so now to show that these things have a transversal non-Clifford gate, you remember that it's the thing which the 15-qubit Reed-Muller code is most best known for is the transversality of a non-Clifford gate. So this was actually first shown in the Neil LaFlamme Zurich paper, but then used very famously by Bravi and Kataev in their magic state paper. So naturally we want to look for transversal gates in the transversal gates of these codes. So how do we find them? Well, let's start by considering gates which are diagonal in the Z basis, because these are the sort of gates we wanted to use for state injection. So this is a completely general diagonal gate. Okay, so let's just apply that transversely and see what happens. So we apply it transversely to our code word, and what we want is to find conditions under which this is a code automorphism, i.e. this maps a code word onto another code word. So we want to end up back in our code space. So simple calculation shows us that each one of these operators in the tensor product will pick up phases depending on the elements of these code words. Okay? And in particular, when we have digit k here, we will pick up phase phi k. So it's therefore straightforward to see that the relevant thing here is the k weights. The k weights count the number of k's in each code word. Therefore, that tells you how many times the phi k phase will arise in this phase factor here. So these k weights really are the key to unlocking this problem and sort of simplifying this construction. And the k weights of the Reed-Muller code are beautifully symmetric. Remember, I said at the beginning, basically, for all of the generators in the linear Reed-Muller code, the k weights were 3 for that example. The k weights are actually d to the m minus 1 for the general case. And when we puncture them, what we do is we remove, when we puncture these codes, we've removed the a 0 from this code, we've removed a 1 from this code word, and we've removed a 2 from this code word. So puncturing has sort of labeled, it's put a nice label into the code that we can use to get this transversal gate. So when we go through this and write down what the k-weights are for these code words, we find this very simple formulas for them. And these deltas represent the bits which were moved when we punctured. And if we could get rid of these other factors and just had these deltas there, if we did that and substituted this back into the expression we had before, we would get a code space automorphism. We would get back to our code space. So this is the key to doing this. Can we choose phases which allow, basically we want these factors to be associated with multiples of 2 pi in this phase factor so that we can neglect them. So if we can substitute that in here and find a way of getting rid of these phase factors, then we've won. Well, it turns out we can do that. I won't show you the details of that because it's quite technical and it's not really enlightening, but it's easy to find, and you can find it in our paper. But the bottom line is, by doing that, we find, yes, we do achieve transversal non-Clifford codes. And even better, we can find transversal non-Clifford codes with just the property we want for state injection. So the property that, when they transform by conjugation an element of the Pauli group, they give us a Clifford group operator. That's the thing we needed to be able for our correction in the state injection circuit to be applied within the framework of the fault-tolerant gates that we have. So we can find a unitary which is non-Clifford, transversal, but has this nice property. Okay. And we're going to call this the magic unitary for obvious reasons. And here's an example of one for this code QRM32. This is what it looks like. You see it has these nice phases, which are a, sort of a ninth. That sort of 9 is 3 squared here, and it comes directly from the fact that this is an m equals 2 code. So it's sort of d. This is really d to the m, this 9 here. And these you can sort of see by inspection that this is transversal on these code words. It puts exactly the right phases on the 3 code words. Okay, so now we have this family of Reed-Muller codes, and we've shown that we get non-Clifford transversal gates in all of them. Let's put this to work for magic state distillation. And the main result will be that we can show that in all prime dimensions, magic state distillation protocols exist, which do have a finite noise threshold. And the particular magic states that we're going to distill are the states M plus, where plus is the plus one eigenstate of the d-dimensional Pauli X. So this was very similar to the sort of state injection state we wanted to have. And the protocol is exactly the same as Bravian-Kataev's protocol. Just use it unaltered, but generalized to higher dimensions. So let's just check that it works. In order to see this, there are a few properties of these magic unitaries M, which I want to point out. So I noted that MXM dagger was a Clifford operator. Let's call that CM. And the eigenbasis of this operator is clearly the eigenbasis of X transformed through M. So that's this eigenbasis here. I'm going to introduce a bit more notation for these states. I mean, it's all fairly obvious stuff. So the plus J will be a label for eigenstates of the X operator, where omega to the j is the eigenvalue. I also need a way of writing down tensor products of these states. So plus u, so u always means a vector in this talk. And here it's the same notation as before. If we have plus u, that means we have basically a vector described by this vector. We have a quantum state described by the state u, described by this vector u, but with respect to the plus basis. And there's an example. So plus 120 is this state. Okay. So now we can just step through the protocol. And the nice thing is that it can really be just understood in a very clean way. So first of all, we twirl. What does twirling do? Well, we're twirling through this unitary CM. That means we're applying the subgroup generated by CM uniformly at random. What does that do? It dephases that should say dephases. It dephases in the m plus k eigenbasis. So we end up with this dephase state, which is now easier to analyze. OK, so now we take n copies of the state. So it looks like this. And now this fu, so these fk's are these amplitudes that we get, which are you can think of as the fidelity of the state with respect to the state m plus k. Okay? And then if we take products of these fidelities, we can sort of write a compact notation like this. And the nice thing to note is straight away we have a tensor product of these m gates, which are transversal. So this is equal to the logical gate, m dagger, which acts on the whole code space. And so really, now what we're going to do is make measurements of the stabilizer generators. But the stabilizer generators commute with all logical operators on the code space. So they commute with ML dagger. That means really that the rest of the distillation process can be understood just in terms of distillation of these X eigenbasis strings. So it's really very simple. And so this next slide is really only for experts in CSS code theory. You know that if you take a state of this form and you measure the X stabilizers, what that does is it removes all of the states in this sum, all of the terms in this sum, which do not have vectors u, which are in the dual of cx. That's what the measurement of the stabilizer does. And remember, the dual of cx is this thing. It's cz with the addition of the all ones generator. So that's what the x stabilizers do. It reduces us down to these things. Now, then we measure the z stabilizers. And what they do is they kind of correct. These all plus states are a bit like dephased logical plus states. And what the Z stabilizer does is it projects these back onto the logical plus state, the logical state which this has a non-zero overlap. Remember, the logical eigenbasis states of these CSS codes are constructed from cosets of code words. So every code word has a non-zero overlap with just one of these cosets, with just one of these logical states. So that's what the Z stabilizer does. It projects it, each one of these U's, onto the coset which it's associated with. Okay, and then we decode, and we're back to a single qubit state. Now, that means the whole magic state distillation process we can analyze analytically and write down an expression for the iteration of the error and how the fidelity with respect to the state f0, which is the state that we want, how it evolves with each iteration. And again, you can sort of, I mean, I'm not going to write down the full expression for this iteration because I don't think it really gives too much insight. But the iteration is very simple. We started off with states which were close to this m0 plus k state. That's our starting assumption, which means this f0 value is quite high. So now when we're taking products of this, see that the one term here which will dominate will be the all zeros term. And what you can find basically is most of the probabilities here which are large will be associated with the plus zero logical state, which is why the distillation works. Okay, so the final part of my talk, I'll actually give you some specific results for the 8 qutrit code. Remember, this was the code that was generated by d equals 3, m equals 2. Okay, and this is a nice map of our magic state. So this is the convex hull of these three magic states. So m plus 0, m plus 1, and m plus 2. Okay, so this is just a slice through the qdit state space. Okay, so on this slice, we can illustrate various regions. There's a stabilizer region, which lives in the middle here. These states we know can't be distilled. But there's also this larger region due to Veitch, Berry, and Emerson, which is the region of non-negative Wigner function. That's this region here, which is supposed to be a different color. It doesn't quite come up on this slide. And these regions here, these yellow regions, are the regions of states which can be distilled. So if we start with a state inside this region, it will be distilled up to these magic states. Okay, and how well does this perform?
The region called physical on there?
Oh, sorry, that's not so important. Physical just means all state.
Oh, I see.
Yes, that shouldn't really be there, I guess. So we want to sort of get an idea of the performance of this. So there's different ways we can quantify that. Firstly, we can look at the threshold. So how much noise can be tolerated before the distillation procedure breaks down? We're going to quantify that following Bravian-Kutayev using this F0, this sort of 1 minus this fidelity F0. And there's a nice operational reason for doing this. If you think of the state injection circuit, this quantity is the probability of a logical error being injected into your circuit when you use this as a resource. We did the numerics for a variety of schemes, and these are the numerical values for the threshold of epsilon where the distillation fails. Okay, and you can see as we increase D, it gets worse and worse. So it performs much worse as we increase D, and likewise as we increase M, we get worse performance. But the nice thing is the best performing code is this. D equals 3 M equals 2 code, which is our 8 Q-trick code. And this is actually performing better than the Bravian-Kutayev code. It has a higher threshold. Now, you could say this is cheating. Why could you say it's cheating? Well, there's one thing in here which is cheating in that we've chosen a sort of measure of noise which in some sense favors qubits. Another measure of noise would be the depolarizing noise rate. So if we map, say, sigma to p times sigma plus 1 minus p times the identity, then that 1 minus p would be another way of quantifying noise rate. We get that noise rate by taking these values here and multiplying them by d over d minus 1. Okay? So that clearly favors higher d. But if we do that here, you see that even in that other regime, the Q-trick code has a better threshold than the qubit code. But what about success probabilities? Now, this is a probabilistic process. We're projecting onto the code space. And you know, there are various tricks you can apply, which means that you don't. It turns out that it's only the measurements of the Z stabilizers which you have to post-select on. But there are certain measurements you make where if you don't get a zero error syndrome, you have to discard the states and try again. So this is a necessarily probabilistic process. We've written down the success probabilities when we're in the small error region, and they're linear. The expressions are very simple, actually. It's just 1 minus the number of dits or bits times epsilon. And from this measure, again, our code beats the Bravian-Kutayev code because it's a smaller code. So we get better success probabilities. But there's another aspect to all this, but this is how much is the error reduced in each step? And this is an aspect where our code isn't as good. So the Bravian-Kutayev code, the error scales with epsilon to the power of 3. With our code, it scales with epsilon to the power of 2. And this is a function of the fact that our code is a distance 2 code, whereas Bravian-Kutayev's is a distance 3 code. So that means that this error per iteration will be decreased quicker. So we have two competing effects here. On one hand, the Bravian-Kutayev code reduces the error more in each iteration, but you're less likely to succeed in an iteration. So to try and combine those two effects, we've plotted a quantity which we're calling the yield, which is essentially given a single copy of a starting state and given a particular target fidelity, what are the average number of these target states that your scheme will generate? Okay, so these are small numbers. So basically, the inverse of this yield is the number of copies of the state you needed to start with to get one copy, the target state. So the blue curves are for the Q-trit code. The red curves are for the Bravian-Kutayev code. And you see that the blue code is significantly better in the region where the initial error is much bigger. Okay. Now, again, there are different ways of quantifying this error. And I'm not going to show you another plot which uses the depolarizing noise rate. But even in that case, the Q-chip code gets a better yield for this sort of large error region. You can see they sort of converge towards the low error region, but on the whole, for most of this region, the blue curve is doing better. Okay, so that's the end of my talk. To summarize, we've shown that magic state distillation can be achieved with a finite threshold in all prime dimensions. I didn't actually talk through the proof that you do get a finite threshold, but it's based on a fairly straightforward analysis of the recursion relation you get for epsilon. And we could do this analytically because we used non-Clifford transversal gates on these quantum Reed-Muller codes. The performance degrades with increasing D, but the Q-trick code was better. So why was the Q-trick code better than the qubit code? Well, the reason for that is that you could construct an M equals 2 code for the Q-trick case, which you can't construct in the qubit case. So the smallest quantum Reed-Muller code for qubits was 15 qubits, whereas the smallest for trits is only 8 trits. And really, this smaller code gives us an advantage in a number of ways. Another nice thing is it's a distance 2 code. We've got some sort of practical use for distance 2 code, which is quite nice. And as I say, this is the smallest code that I'm aware of that has a transversal non-Clifford gate. And it doesn't really have a qubit analog. Okay, so there are a number of open questions that we still need to think about. One is just really, I was quite surprised that we were the first people to discover this code, particularly the 8 Q-trick code. We have scoured the literature as much as we can, and so far we haven't found anyone else who'd written this down before. Maybe it is out there, but it sort of is such a striking code that it motivates us to look for other Q-trick codes. And really, work in this area has been dominated by work on qubits. There's been relatively little work on higher dimensions, and maybe there are some hidden gems lurking there. In terms of using this for quantum computation, there's one key aspect that we need to show. We need to really prove that the Clifford group augmented by our magic unitaries are universal. We believe they are, and as Daniel said, it may be a corollary of the paper that I mentioned earlier. But certainly this is something we're working on, and I think we're making good progress. This is the sort of the final technical thing we want to fix up before we submit the paper. And really this motivates now an investigation of Q-trip versions of these high threshold schemes such as Rausendorf's fault tolerance scheme and Mani-Nil's fault tolerance scheme. And you know, is Nil's intuition that maybe there's an advantage for these schemes in Q-trips going to work? I mean, the only way to really test this is to find out. So this will be some future work that we're going to try. Okay, so this work is, as I said, in an unpublished paper. The paper is fairly advanced, so I can give you a draft if you'd like to see it. It has a few sort of rough bits, but it's largely complete. Our earlier paper is on the archive. And I'd like to thank all of these people who we have discussed these things with, both in person and also online. So thanks very much for listening.
Any questions?
So, sorry, when you said the probability of acceptance,
yes,
they were 1 minus epsilon, but isn't there some, I mean, even if there's no errors, you're projecting some tensor product state onto a closed space, right? So there should be some constant factor there, right?
No, there isn't. This was not noticed by us. This was also noticed by Bravi and Kataev. It's a special property of magic state distillation with CSS codes, and the fact that your measurements of your, let me get it the right way around, the measurements of the Z stabilizers, there's actually a unitary correction. So, the X stabilizers, you have to post-select, but you don't have to post-select on the Z stabilizers,
okay.
And that's why the probability goes to 1. But that doesn't happen for, say, magic state distillation with the 5 qubit code, for example.
Yeah, right. More questions? No further questions? And then let's thank Dan again.
Thank you.